It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. This next report may cause people to rethink what they believe about sexual assault on college campuses. It's commonly assumed that men who commit sexual assault made a one-time bad decision, maybe clouded by too much drinking. But one person who has studied campus rape says that assumption is wrong, dangerously wrong. The NPR investigative team worked with journalists at the Center for Public Integrity to look at the problem of sexual assault on campus. NPR's Joseph Shapiro has this report.
Most of what we know about men who commit rape comes from studying the ones who are in prison. But most rapes are never reported or prosecuted. So David Lisak of the University of Massachusetts, Boston, wanted to interview what he calls undetected rapists, the men who are never charged or convicted. He found them by asking some 2,000 men in college questions like this.
Have you ever had sexual intercourse with someone, even though they did not want to, because they were too intoxicated to resist your sexual advances?
About 1 in 16 men answered yes to this or similar questions. You might think it'd be hard for a researcher to get these men to admit to something that fits the definition of rape. But Lisak, a psychologist who studies rapists, says it's not.
They are very forthcoming, and in fact, they're eager to talk about their experiences. They're quite narcissistic as a group, the offenders, and they view this as an opportunity, essentially, to brag.
What Lisak found was that students who commit rape on a college campus are pretty much like those rapists in prison. In both groups, many are serial rapists. On college campuses, these repeat predators account for 9 out of every 10 rapes. They, too, look for the most vulnerable women, even if they don't use guns or knives.
The basic weapon is alcohol. If you can get a victim intoxicated to the point where she's coming in and out of consciousness or she's unconscious, and that is a very, very common scenario, then, you know, why would you need a weapon? Why would you need a knife or a gun?
Stetson University law professor Peter Lake agrees that there are plenty of predators on campus and that it's important to spot them and get them out of school. But Lake says there's a problem the predator theory underestimates. That's the amount of drinking and sex that's become common with many, although certainly not all, college students.
It's very common for them to go out, drink fairly heavily, and hook up sexually with people that they may not know particularly well. So you have a lot of sexual activity, you have alcohol, you have a population that's sort of an at-risk age, and it's in some ways the perfect storm for sexual assault issues.
Lake, who's written about the evolution of school disciplinary procedures, says that as a result, most schools address sexual assault mainly as a violation of conduct codes.
Having done discipline for 10 years myself, hands-on, I was our honor code investigator for almost 10 years. What surprised me was how many people have made terrible mistakes and can actually learn to be better people from that, that there still is a chance for teachable moments.
But David Lisak, the psychologist, says schools put too much faith in teachable moments when they ought to treat sexual assault as a criminal matter.
These are clearly not individuals who are simply in need of a little extra education about proper communication with the opposite sex. These are predators.
At Texas A&M, Elton Yarbrough was a promising student. Then he was linked to 5 rapes. The first woman went to the Student Health Center. She says a staffer blamed her for having been drunk, so she didn't report to campus police. A year later, when the 4th woman called, the Student Health Center was closed for a holiday. The answering machine said to call 911 in an emergency. She did, and got city police. Jennifer Peebles reported the case for the Center for Public Integrity.
And College Station police were there within a few minutes. They seemed to have absolutely taken the case very seriously and investigated it.
On a recent morning, Peebles went to visit Yarbrough at a Texas prison. He spoke freely about the women. He recounted the sex and how, he claims, they'd come on to him.
He feels strongly that he didn't do anything against the law. He says he feels like he made a bad decision and that the young woman made, or young women made, a bad decision with him to have sex with them.
In the rape that went to trial, a Texas jury ruled that this was the bad decision of a predator. Elton Yarbrough was sentenced to 18 years in prison. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
You can find more stories in our Seeking Justice series by going to npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris, and we begin this hour in the driver's seat with the latest on Toyota's recent safety troubles. You won't hear this news anywhere else. It comes from NPR's investigative team. Our own Robert Benincasa, who helps us find the stories in statistics, has been looking into acceleration problems, but not just at Toyota. He's crunched the numbers for all of the automakers over the last two decades, and you might be surprised by what he found. We certainly were. And Robert joins me now. Robert, first the basics. What were you looking at and what did you find?
Well, we got a database of 15,000 complaints from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. That's the federal agency that regulates auto safety. And going back about 10 years when these complaints started proliferating, they go out throughout the auto industry. It's not just a Toyota problem.
Where else did you see this? What other automakers were involved in this?
Well, it touched a lot of different automakers. There's some good examples. In the 2008 model year, Volkswagens had a high rate of complaint. Hondas in the early part of the decade had a relatively high rate of complaints. And then in 2004, they seemed to have fixed something and the complaints dropped.
So it seems to be a question of not just how these problems surface, but how the companies handle these problems. We've seen in the past few weeks how Toyota is handling this. How have other companies handled this comparatively?
In some cases, they have a recall. And in other cases, their technology gets better. One interesting case is Volvo, where in the early part of the decade, they had a significant rate of complaints. They had a recall, and they fixed some of their electronics and some of the other issues. And then in the past several years, they've had a very low rate of acceleration complaints.
So if you're looking at Toyota in comparison to these other companies, could someone make the argument that Toyota responded too slowly to these complaints?
Well, that's the kind of thing that the federal regulators are investigating. The complaint patterns aren't going to really tell us the whole story on that. The regulators, they're going to have to get under the hood of Toyota and find out, you know, what they knew and when and that sort of thing.
Since you mentioned the complaint patterns, tell us a little bit more about what you found looking at Toyota specifically in this database that you were studying.
Well, Toyota's problems seem to go back to 2002. The complaints started to get high back then, and that's a few years before this recall that we've been hearing about with the floor mats and the sticky gas pedals. So back in 2002, they had about 10% of the U.S. auto market, and they had about 19% of the complaints on acceleration.
I understand that you showed your analysis to Clarence Ditlow at the Center for Auto Safety. That's a consumer watchdog organization. What did he tell you about all this?
Well, he said that when an automaker's complaints are well above their market share, regulators should start asking some questions.
Is there some problem with the electronics? Is there some problem with the pedal configuration that's causing driver error?
Is anyone doing that?
There's no one doing it as far as I know. Now, this is the first time I've seen an analysis like this in a long time, and not since the 1980s when sudden acceleration first hit the headlines did we see a manufacturer-based analysis of complaints. But it's something the government could and should be doing every year.
So Clarence Ditlow with the Center for Auto Safety seems to be saying that the government regulators have not been as aggressive as they should be.
Well, you know, Michelle, as Toyota's problems have unfolded very publicly and we've heard these horrible stories about runaway cars, the regulators have taken some heat from people like Ditlow and members of Congress, of course. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood has defended the agency. He's saying that their monitoring of safety problems is continuous and pretty aggressive. We invited someone from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to be here with us today, and they declined.
Could you help with this in perspective? You're saying that the problem is not limited to Toyota, that it surfaced with other automakers. How common is it statistically?
I don't think you could describe unintended acceleration as a common problem. It does go throughout the industry. Mr. Ditlow told us that the rule of thumb that he suggested to us was that we look at how many complaints there are versus how many vehicles were sold. And when you get above more than 10 complaints per 100,000 vehicles, then you have to start looking at, well, is there an issue here?
And where is it above that level, 10 complaints per?
It has been for some automakers in some years, it has been above that level, yes.
Now, Robert, I understand that you've put the results of your analysis up on our website. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, they can visit our site, npr.org, and choose their car's model year. And then they can get a listing of how many complaints were associated with that automaker for that year and compared to how many cars they sold. And they can even drill down and look at the numbers of complaints for each model.
Fantastic work, Robert.
Thank you, Michelle.
Robert Benincasa is part of the NPR investigative team. Thanks so much. Some of us think about what we eat only on holidays, some of us all the time, some of us, well, not at all. For those of you who would like to eat healthier but can't bear to hear about the latest fad diet, you're in luck. NPR's Art Silverman has some fresh advice for you.
Most people assume that even if they eat well, they won't be able to live for 1,000 years or forever. But they do want to stay healthy and happy for their entire lives, then die a painless and quick death doing something heroic. Is that too much to ask? So many people try to pay attention to what they eat. It becomes a religion to them. They set down rules. We sampled some people's rules in a Washington suburb to hear how they vary.
My food rule is that I'm really, really picky about my meat, like who's making it. I want to know where it's coming from.
I eat one thing on the plate at a time till it's gone, then I move on to the next. So I eat salad, then meat, then vegetables.
I usually avoid having pancakes or waffles or anything.
When it comes to sweets or cookies, I put them in my mouth, I taste it, then I spit it out.
I will only eat the food if I know exactly who has made that food.
I usually don't eat things out of plastic bags.
We're kind of lost in what has become a very treacherous food landscape. Eating has gotten really complex.
That's Michael Pollan. He's a crusader for changing the way we think about food, and he thinks we think about what we eat in ways that just don't make sense. He doesn't care much for those fads that create a mythology around proper ways to eat. He has a common sense slogan, which is, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Michael Pollan's latest book is called Food Rules.
This is a book that you can read in about 20 minutes or a half hour, and it's got 64 rules. Not all of them are going to stick. But my hope is that a couple will stick and that they will kind of be part of your bag of tricks when you enter the supermarket or the farmer's market. So I'm not expecting anyone to memorize 64 rules. In fact, a lot of them take you to the same place. You know, the rule, you know, don't eat anything that your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food is not so different than the rule that says don't eat any foods you've seen advertised on television.
And Michael Pollan suggests other common sense rules that are cloaked in humor. Here's rule 21.
It's not food if it's called by the same name in every language.
By that, Michael Pollan means Big Mac, Pringles, Cheetos. Rule 19.
If it came from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't.
It's sort of like an extended Ten Commandments to keep you from straying from the path of wellness.
We do have a very religious view of food. Whenever we're eating, we think that this activity takes place on a spectrum, at one end of which is we're ruining our health because we're eating the junk we want to eat, and at the other end of the spectrum, we're redeeming our health. And I really think that that's a shame because in my own experience, the best food for your health is the most pleasurable food, and there is not a trade-off between eating well and eating pleasurably.
But in truth, people stumble way outside the orthodoxy of food rules. And by publishing this book, Michael Pollan sets himself up to be thought of as a high priest of eating right. When word got around NPR that Michael Pollan had food rules, colleagues who strayed felt the need to confess. The first was reporter Ari Shapiro.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, for I have committed a food sin. I was just in Austin, Texas, and I drowned in queso.
You know, I'm not sure that that does break the rules. I'd have to see the recipes. If it's really Velveeta, my attitude is don't eat foods that are pretending to be something they're not.
Well, thank you for absolving me of my food sin.
Next into the confessional booth was producer Neil Carruth.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, but I've committed the food sin of eating way too much candy.
Candy. It's a special occasion food. It's a treat. Don't stop eating candy, but just think about when you have it and if you can put it back up on its pedestal of being special.
And finally, our cake lady came by, producer Melissa Gray, author of All Cakes Considered.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, for I have sinned. In addition to the cake that I push on the staff every Monday, I also have a weakness, an indulgence, for Chef Boyardee beef ravioli in a can.
Now that's nasty.
No, it's not.
Well, you know, if you enjoy Chef Boyardee beef ravioli and I don't, that's fine. It's fine. But I've also been to the feedlots where that meat was produced. That's, you know, the little bit of it that's in the middle of those things. And, you know, I have a little more trouble with it than you do. You know, I really don't like this role of being food super ego to people like you. I'm really sorry. But There is no one proper way to eat, and anyone who tells you that is crazy.
Unlike the tablets that came down from Mount Sinai, Michael Pollan includes one final commandment Moses never thought of.
Rule number 64 is you should break the rules from time to time.
Amen. That's Michael Pollan. The book is Food Rules, Wisdom for Those Among Us Who Tend to Eat Food. Art Silverman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ricky Gervais became famous worldwide for starring in and co-creating a British TV series that only a few million Americans have seen, the original version of The Office, which was first shown in England on the BBC. The American version, starring Steve Carell on NBC, is one of the 8 international versions of The Office, with more on the way. After The Office, Gervais went on to create Extras with his writing partner Stephen Merchant, and he co-wrote and stars in the film The Invention of Lying, which just came out on DVD. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke with Ricky Gervais last week. They began by talking about his latest project, an animated HBO series, The Ricky Gervais Show, which airs Fridays. It features the freewheeling conversations which he recorded with Stephen Merchant and a radio producer, Carl Pilkington, who's the real star of the show. These were initially produced as podcasts which made it into the 2007 Guinness Book of World Records as the most downloaded podcast on the Internet. What did they talk about? Here's an example. Stephen Merchant is posing this hypothetical question to Carl Pilkington. If you could choose any superpower, what would it be?
Remember, you've already got opposable thumbs. So that, cross that one off the list.
Oh, go on, Carl.
There are so many to choose from. Telepathy, X-ray vision.
Flight. Invisibility.
Choose it wisely.
Strength.
Intelligence.
But why have I been picked?
Oh, for God's sake.
No, but I'm just saying...
It's Rob's question for you.
But I'd just say, does anyone else want this?
Ricky Gervais, welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure to be here.
I love that he's immediately questioning the premise.
Yeah, of course, he doesn't... He's quite cautious, and he asks questions that you never dreamt he would ever ask or need to ask. He hasn't got a pretentious bone in his body. I think it's impossible for him. The concept of pretension does not exist in his world. So everything you get is unfiltered and honest. He downloads his brain for your pleasure. I mean, I think what he comes down to eventually when pressured is invisibility. And we ask him what he'd do with this, and he decides that he'd go into a shop and, be invisible, wait for the shop to shut, and then he would shop at his leisure, buy some records, pay for them, and leave. That's what... he would use his superpower for. I mean, we were doing one audiobook, I think it was the Ricky Gervais Guide to Philosophy, and I posed him the Robert Nozick scenario, where if you could script your life, perfectly pre-programmed your life, you could get into a float tank and you'd live a virtual life, a perfect life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would you choose that or reality with all the pain and suffering? And but it's real, and I think most people would probably choose a real life. Carl pondered this, and his virtual life, his perfect existence, turned out to be exactly the life he's got now, but his boiler would work. And again, I don't think he was making the most of the opportunity.
Well, you know, I always look at it thinking, is he putting you on? Is he putting me on? And then I finally decided, tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, that Carl Pilkington is to you and Stephen Merchant what Margaret Dumont was for the Marx Brothers. I mean, someone who has no clue how funny you are, much less how funny they are.
Yeah. I mean, Carl, I don't know what Carl laughs at in his own life, what he finds amusing. He's quite a serious... You'd think he was a tortured, troubled soul, but he's not. He's just quite happy doing the stuff he does. He's, the only time he's not happy is when he can't get to do the same stuff he does every day. He likes pottering around. He likes doing nothing. He likes sitting in tea shops, eating cake with his girlfriend. He's just, he's totally happy with that. That he actually said he's looking forward to being old. He said, one, he said, old people are no trouble. I don't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. They're no trouble. Like, you can wrangle them easy or they don't get into fights. I don't know. Yeah. But he says he's looking forward to being old because then you can just sit out in the street in a chair and no one gives you dirty looks like you're lazy. I mean, that's an ambition. That's a hell of an ambition, isn't it?
I have one last question about the Ricky Gervais show, and that's the animation style. I know that there were fans who were sort of doing animated versions of some of the podcasts, and then you come out with a TV show version of it, which is brilliant recycling, if nothing else. I'm wondering, yep. Is the animation style, is it based more on Flintstones, Hanna-Barbera, or Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Certainly, that was the remit. I did a sketch of myself initially for the animation house, and I wanted it to be a cross between Hanna-Barbera and 1950s children's comics of Britain, like the Beano and the Dandy. And there was a very good reason for that. I wanted it to be warm and approachable and not spiky and trendy and innovative in that sense. Because for two reasons, I wanted people to know that this is quite a nice, cuddly show. Because on the face of it, it's quite challenging. We're talking about, you know, there are no taboo subjects. We talk about race, disability. And I wanted people to know it was, like, safe and sweet. And Carl is quite childlike. Anything he says is not malicious. He doesn't wish harm on anyone. I mean, he's fascinated by difference, but I think in the best way, in the same way that a child is. A child stares because he hasn't seen it before. There's no malice. It's the parents that are embarrassed when they say, don't look. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are embarrassed socially. A child's just looking at stuff. And Carl's like that. Carl is like that. Carl is asking genuine questions without prejudice. The fact that he comes out with horrendous statements, I have to explain to people that he's an idiot. He thought that Anne
How
Frank,
nice of you to explain that.
Well, of course, I have to. It's my job. but he thought that Anne Frank was just avoiding paying rent. We had to explain to him that she was hiding from the Nazis because he has no formal education. He doesn't, you know, it's like people take things for granted because we've been learning all our life and from an early age, and now we think everyone knows these things, but Carl doesn't. Carl doesn't know these things. Throughout the podcast, throughout the 5 or 6 years, there's things that seem so obvious to us that are revelations to him. And I think that people should know that they're going to see over this, you know, these however many seasons we do, we're going to see Carl get slightly more educated. I mean, even arrogant in his stupidity sometimes, where he gets more confident, which is my favourite, like, you know, a la Homer Simpson. There was one point I was trying to explain evolution to him.
Oh, yes.
And he went, yeah. He said, I've got the gist of it. I go, go on. He went, I know it went germ, fish, mermaid, man. Mermaid. Unbelievable.
We're speaking with Ricky Gervais, co-star and co-creator of BBC's The Office and of the HBO series Extras and the new Ricky Gervais Show, which premiered last month and airs Fridays on HBO. Here in the States, The Office was shown on BBC America and seen by a couple of million people. So most people haven't seen you in America for the role for which you are so internationally famous. They know the NBC version, but they haven't seen you as David Brent. And I thought that I'd start off this section by playing a clip from The Office.
There's good news and bad news. The bad news is Neil will be taking over both branches and some of you will lose your jobs. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Those of you who are kept on will have to relocate to Swindon if you want to. So, yeah. Stay. I know. Gutting. You didn't see me. On a more positive note, the good news is I've been promoted. So,
every cloud. You're still thinking about the bad news, aren't you?
I do think that's one of the most pitch-perfect characters and comedies ever done for television. And
thank you very much.
It seemed fully formed at the beginning. And I'm wondering if you really had that sort of confidence going in both the character and the presentation from the very start.
Yeah, I was confident in the character. It didn't feel like an acting job. It felt like I was doing an impression of someone I'd never met before, which I suppose is what acting is, really. But I was much more worried about the realism of the piece. I wanted to keep in all the fluffs, all the mouth touching, all the things that rustled the microphone. Directorially, the realism, the motivation, the players. I always hated exposition. You know, when people would come in and say, "John, you know your sister, the one who went to the Gambia?"
Mm-hmm.
"Yes, of course I do. She's my sister. Why are you..." You know, you might as well look at the camera. And so we tried to avoid that, and we tried to make everything organic. We didn't want people entering, doing a scene, and then leaving in opposite directions. So we had to find them. And I think that's what people connected with initially, was the realism of the piece, and saying, I know someone like that. And we peppered them with the annoyance of mundane life. You know, some people say that drama is real life with the boring bits taken out. Well, we left them in, and we made a feature of them. And the aftermath was so much more tantalising to us than the event. You know, what happens after someone's told a bad joke that didn't go down well?
Right.
That's a bit of an awkward, you know, moment.
Extras was the series that you did after The Office. And you play Andy Millman, a film extra who desperately wants to get speaking lines in the films in which he appears. And as the series goes on, he succeeds in that quite wildly. But I want to play this early clip. This is one of my favorite moments from the series. He's an extra in a movie about a nun who hides Jews from Nazis during World War II. And your character, Andy, is dressed as a Nazi, and the movie's star, Kate Winslet, is in costume as a nun. And between scenes, they have this little chat.
I'd just like to say, I think, you know, you doing this is so commendable, you know, using your profile to keep the message alive about the Holocaust.
My God, I'm not doing it for that. I mean, I don't think we really need another film about the Holocaust, do we? It's like, how many have there been? You know, we get it. It was grim. Move on. No, I'm doing it because I've noticed that if you do a film about the Holocaust, guaranteed an Oscar. I've been nominated 4 times. Never won. And the whole world is going, why hasn't Winslet won one?
Death, yeah.
That's it. That's why I'm doing it. Schindler's Bloody List. The Pianist. Oscars coming out of their arse.
You know, it's absolutely hilarious. And what makes it even funnier, of course, is that, you know, years
life
later...
Life imitated art.
Yeah,
exactly.
She
actually
won an Oscar for The Reader, and which was a Holocaust film. And we know, because you were on the Oscars as a presenter, what you said to her that night. What did she say to you?
She just laughed. She laughed. We've actually done a retrospective that's coming out in April in England about extras, and we've got all the stars to chat about their episode. And she says on there, Ricky Gervais thinks that Oscar's half is. It's not.
What do you think the percentage is?
I think about 50-50. She's about half it. She keep the globe.
Well, you know, here was an idea, a really different idea for a television series, where you get to show pieces of these actual films, and therefore it's the perfect excuse to bring in guest stars. But the series is not about those movies at all. It's about your ambition and your friendships. And
I suppose it's I think people, you know, obviously the big names got the press heat that, you know, that was, I think it was remarkable that we got Kate Winslet and Sam Jackson and Robert De Niro and David Bowie to pop up in a a little sitcom. I mean, it was remarkable. But I think I'd rather do stuff that makes a big connection with a few people than a small connection with loads. I'd rather this be a few people's favourite show than, you know, millions and millions of people's 10th favourite show, because what's the point otherwise? And that's what I wanted to do. And also, even though the backdrop of it looks like it's media, it's not. Just like The Office wasn't really about selling paper, it was about a few people thrown together, you know, an arbitrary existence, walking the same carpet every day. Mm-hmm. And Extras wasn't really about filmmaking and film stars. It was about a group of friends trying to get on with different ambitions. It was important that we made them the bottom rung of the ladder, because no one wants to see, you know, unfeasibly handsome, brilliant people doing brilliant things. Where's the fun in that? Yeah. We want to see a struggle. We want to see people falling over but getting themselves back up on their feet. And that's what's extraordinary. Ordinary people, their struggle. There's nothing as interesting as real life out your window. You walk down the street for half an hour, I'll give you half an hour of drama.
Religion is a continuing theme in your work, and especially the way that you espouse opinions through your characters about atheism. This is during an episode of Extras, the same one with Kate Winslet. And in this one, you have, you know, nuns and Nazis walking around in costume as extras. And Andy, your character, is talking with his best friend, a fellow movie extra played by Ashley Jensen. She's now on the TV series Ugly Betty here in the States. In this scene, she plays Maggie, a sweet but not very bright young woman, who tells Andy there's something about the movie they're filming that bothers her.
All these people going about pretending to be nuns.
What do you mean?
Do you think that's right?
It's a film.
I know, but they're all like wandering around as holy ladies. Won't that offend God or something?
Offend God or someone?
But does it not worry you a bit?
No. What, offending God? I'm an atheist.
What one's that? Is that the one where you haven't decided what you want
to do? No, it's agnostic. I'm an atheist. I firmly believe there is no God.
Why?
What do you mean, what? The burden of proof's not on me. The burden of proof is on the people who say there is a God. I don't believe in God. I believe in science.
So do you not believe in anything like ghosts or spirits or anything?
No, I don't believe in ghosts or spirits or elves. It's certainly not God, no.
So what do you think happens when you die?
Well, if you're buried, you go in the ground and you're worm food.
See, I don't like that. I would rather believe that there is a God and your soul just floats away onto eternity and all your friends from school will be there, like all the ones you haven't seen for ages and all your dead pets and just like, oh, nice people. You don't have to worry about worms.
You believe in God, then?
Now, what are you thinking as you replay this?
I think that was a very sweet, funny clip that actually housed a very important point. It was someone who that was genuine, and her reasons for believing in God were that the alternative wasn't very nice. And I think that's a lot of people's reason for believing in God. That if there isn't a God, what's the point? Why are we here? Why are we born and we live this life of struggle and pain if there's nothing at the end of it? Well, I wish there was a God, but I can't believe in something that I don't. And I suppose that is personal in a sense, although it's not personal to talk about religion because of the effect it has on society as a whole.
I don't know what your own upbringing was. I know that you were one of four children, but I don't know if you grew up in a religious household, if you...
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a very working class upbringing. My dad was a labourer. My mum was a housewife. And I don't know how much they believed, but I know for a working class mother, Jesus is like an unpaid babysitter. If she's not watching me, someone is. And also I think that, you know, the best you can hope for in a, you know, poor working class accommodations is not that your son becomes an international comedian, but that he doesn't die in a barroom fight before he's clever enough to take, you know, care of himself. And that, you know, I think that if you if you're a God-fearing person and you live, you know, your life by Christian values, is a good rule of thumb, then you'll probably be okay. And so, you know, she did her best. And I believed in God till I was 8. And I remember I was doing some homework from the Bible, and my brother, who was a lot older than me, he was 11 years older than me, he was about 19, he came in and he just said, "Why do you believe in God?" And my mum went, "Bob." And I knew that she had something to hide and he had something to tell me.
Now, watching television in the States right, you know, during the Olympics, it was unavoidable to see promos for Jerry Seinfeld's new series, The Marriage Ref. And at some point, you started getting promoted on that as a guest. Now, it looks like it's a panel show with comedy, and you're famously not married in real life, correct?
Yeah, I'm not. You'd say I wasn't married in the eyes of God.
Oh. Or in the eyes of a civil, yes.
Although, you know, I am with the same woman that we've lived together for 25 years. So I think we're probably more stable than most marriages.
Okay.
I think that's probably above average.
And my question
in terms of longevity.
Yeah, okay. And my question was not, I was not trying to question your personal relationship so much as to question your experience on The Marriage Ref. What was that like?
Yeah.
Who were you with?
Myself, Madonna, and Larry David. I mean,
oh,
there's a dream
team. What was
the
green room like for that show?
Wow. It was the strangest show I've ever been on with us just giving... I mean, I can't imagine three more different opinions. And it was great to see how the panellists interacted as well. At one point, Madonna has a go at Larry David, accused him of being a misogynist because he's always coming down on the side of the man. I mean, Madonna arguing with Larry David. Oh, well, I did lose it a few times. I was saying, this is weird. What am I doing here? I mean, look at this. What, Larry David, Madonna and Ricky Gervais giving people advice. I mean, is that the first point of call? That people are having trouble with their marriage, they go, well, call Madonna. Call Larry David. Call that fat bloke from England. But they do a good job. I don't think you'd have seen a panel show quite like it.
Well, panel shows as a TV critic is something that I miss, and that's a troika that I really would like to see on television.
I've never done them before. I've never do panel shows. But when Jerry Seinfeld calls you on your cell phone and says, "Hello, it's Jerry Seinfeld here. Do you want to do a show with Madonna and Larry David?" The answer's yes. The answer's yes. I'll never have that opportunity again.
When you do award shows, what's your opinion afterwards about how the people in those specific rooms react to what you're saying? What comes off better than you expected? What doesn't?
You know, I think you've got to assume that when you do comedy, if it's got any edge at all or is worth anything, that as many people are going to dislike it as like it. You know, you can't choose your sense of humour. It's like sexuality. You can't pretend to laugh at something you don't find funny. You know, it's very peculiar and very personal. So you can only do stuff that, you know, you find funny, and I hope it's entertaining. But with that, you know, there are caveats. I don't want to just go out there and do safe, anodyne stuff that everyone will find mildly amusing, but, you know, they could do it themselves. Likewise, I don't want to go out there and bring the room down. I don't want to go out there... It was funny because... the Mel Gibson gag, where I said, "I like a drink as much as the next man, unless the next man is Mel Gibson."
Yeah.
There was one journalist in New York said, "I noticed Mr. Gervais had a go at Mel Gibson's alcoholism, but failed to mention his anti-Semitism." Yeah, that would have been a nice half hour, wouldn't it? Yeah, let's talk about the Holocaust. And well done to Glee.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't the forum for it. I wasn't giving anyone a hard time for their personal beliefs. I was having a laugh. I was ribbing the people who are much more successful and famous and richer and more handsome than me. But it was all done in good fun. I had no targets. I've got nothing against those people. But likewise, as I say, I don't want to go out there and make it very, very stuffy and safe and just anodyne. So you've got to do it for yourself. And I think I pitched it about right.
Ricky Gervais, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Ricky Gervais spoke with Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli. Gervais' new HBO animated series, The Ricky Gervais Show, airs Fridays on HBO. It's adapted from his podcasts with Stephen Merchant and Carl Pilkington. You can learn about Carl Pilkington's theory of human reproduction in a clip from The Ricky Gervais Show on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
My baby don't care for shows. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me.
Nobody sounds like Nina Simone. Born in North Carolina and trained at Juilliard, she became an icon of American music, equally talented as a writer, composer, and songwriter. And in the struggles of the civil rights movement, she also became a voice of action and anger. Nadine Cahotas has written a new biography of the singer. It's called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone. Her book charts the life of a performer whose music was always an extension and a response to the world around her.
I believe she is as important for what she represents as what she left behind, and that is this unapologetic rage at the condition of blacks in America once she embraced the civil rights movement. You know, we speak now of thinking we might be approaching a post-racial era. We talk about crossing the racial divide. Nina had no interest in that. She wanted to confront it. There were points when she said to her black audience, "Listen to me, do something. Get up, you know, be active." And perhaps, you know, one of the sweeter aspects of that is 1969 when she writes To Be Young, Gifted in Black.
That song actually was then became a staple of choirs in largely black schools across the country. I mean, starting at about age six,
right,
students learned how to sing that song.
Right. And you know what's interesting? Musically, it's not the most complicated song, but that's all right. It was serving a particular purpose.
Mm-hmm. Even the title itself, To Be Young, Gifted in Black, was a statement of its own.
Right. And in Nina, as with others, it had the ring of autobiography.
You know, when you talk about her activism, she sounds almost a bit strident in the description, but she was very playful at times in trying to bring people along. You hear that in a song like Backlash.
When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash.
The lyrics are very, very angry. But it's almost like a Broadway ballad in her
Yes,
hands.
But you know why you hear that playfulness? This is a Langston Hughes poem,
right,
and you can't do any better than putting to music words by Langston Hughes.
Nina Simone spent much of her life overseas. Why did she leave the United States, and why did she essentially stay away from the United States? She never really came back for good.
Nina herself said in 1982, when a documentary was made about her life, that she didn't feel the United States was her home anymore. And where others might have seen racial progress, she never felt it inside. Added to that was her rock-solid belief that she had not gotten her due professionally, both in terms of reputation, but also, like so many other artists, that she hadn't gotten proper payment for records that were successful. And added to that, she simply wanted nothing more to do with the country. And in fact, she wrote her oldest brother a note and would refer to the United Snakes of America. Mm.
So there was a lot of anger.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like at the record industry, yes.
Oh, very much so, very much so. There are incidents that I recount in the book where you could say maybe she actually is out of control. And at a couple points, her good friend James Baldwin happens to be in the audience. And he comes up on stage and does the only thing you can do. He just puts his arms around her and whispers in her ear. And we don't know what he said, but whatever it was, it worked. And I think this also touches on another aspect of Nina, that I think Nina was not well at certain points, and in fact later in her life was on medication that helped avert these wild mood swings and this extraordinary rage that could come out. So when you add that all together, she just felt more comfortable in Europe, but as we know, she's not the only black musician who felt the same way.
I want to talk to you about Nina Simone's artistry, and when we do, why don't we just listen to one of her songs that I think speaks to something that I think few artists could probably do in quite this way. It's a live performance of the song Nina. You hear her singing, almost chanting, and it sounds like a wail, but it comes from somewhere deep down inside. What is it that we're hearing here?
In part, I think she's clearly in the moment and finding where she wants to go with the song. This is somebody who started out with a piano, bass, and drums as a jazz musician. There is nothing about playing something like Birdland in this, and you hear influences from Africa and the Middle East, and it goes to her eclecticism.
Her final appearance in New York in 2002, I want to ask you about that. And where she was at that point in her life.
There are actually two performances, and it was so striking to hear George Ween, the great entrepreneur, speak about Nina. And he remembered she got paid a very large amount of money. Carnegie Hall was full. Nina could come out, and there were glimpses of the Nina Simone who used to be, and she liked to wave a feather duster, and she sang for 45 minutes. It wasn't great, but everybody was just applauding and was so thrilled to see her, and as he said, she became a goddess of culture.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.
Nadine Curtis, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. I appreciate your interest in
Nina.
Thank
you so much.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.
Nadine Curtis, her book is called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone.
Little darling, it's been a long, cold and lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since you've been here. Here comes the sun.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Over the past couple of days, we've been considering how the financial crisis has affected retirement savings. Many people, of course, have been joking about how they'll never get to retire now. Some people are not joking. But even before the market crash cracked many nest eggs, the U.S. retirement system was in trouble. NPR's John Itzty reports.
Most American workers were woefully unprepared for retirement before the financial crisis struck. Now they're even worse off.
The financial crisis certainly laid bare how inadequate our retirement saving system is.
That's Alicia Munell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Munell points out that a third of all workers will likely end up depending on Social Security for all of their retirement income.
Only half the people are covered by any type of employer-provided plan.
And most of those are 401k plans, which require employees to contribute and make investment decisions. Even before the financial crisis, the average balance in those 401ks for workers nearing retirement was just $78,000. After the market plunge, that was reduced to about $56,000, according to Munell's calculations. That's just not enough for a comfortable retirement, says Roger W. Ferguson, Jr., president and CEO of TIAA-CREF, the financial services company.
Many families at this stage are probably going to be short maybe $250,000 from what they would need ideally for retirement.
That number comes from a study done by the consulting firm McKinsey & Company. To help meet the challenge, President Obama wants to require businesses that don't offer pensions or retirement savings plans to automatically enroll their workers in IRAs, individual retirement accounts. He would also provide tax credits to partially match the workers' contributions. In recent years, the limits on contributions to IRAs and 401ks have been raised. And in addition, the government has encouraged businesses that do offer 401k programs to also automatically enroll workers unless they specifically decline. Ferguson says it's a good first step, but Alicia Munell believes these initiatives aren't enough.
I also think we need a whole new tier of retirement income, both for those people who have to rely solely on Social Security and for those people who have 401k plans.
Munell thinks it should be government-mandated savings, but she says it would likely need to be managed by the private sector to be politically palatable.
Her critique is absolutely right.
That's John Bogle, who founded Vanguard, the big mutual fund company.
Among the things we need, if we get the government to set the structure, is a government agency that says you can only participate in the money manager, if your fees are reasonable.
And, says Bogle, retirement money managers should have a fiduciary responsibility, a legal requirement to act in the investor's best interests. That's something we fall short of today. Plus, he says, easy withdrawal from retirement savings shouldn't be allowed. But TIAA-CREF's Roger Ferguson is skeptical of constructing a new tier of retirement savings.
I think it's very hard in this day and age to talk about another government mandate.
Ferguson believes a serious effort at education, coupled with nudging people in the right direction through automatic enrollment and automatic savings increases, could solve much of the problem.
Many people don't realize that they need to save between 10 and 14% of their pre-retirement gross income to have a reasonable income replacement when they retire. And I think if we talked much more about it, then people would wake up and recognize, you know, how much they have to do.
Finally, Ferguson says, more attention should be paid to getting people to convert at least part of the retirement nest egg into a guaranteed lifetime income stream so they don't outlive their retirement savings. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.